Welcome back to the program. On June 12, 1994, a double homicide would take place in Brentwood, California that would forever change the way we view crime, criminal procedure, and the American justice system. Arguably, few crimes and trials have ever drawn as big an audience as the trial of O.J. Simpson for the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. The players, the events, the moments are still powerfully etched in the public consciousness, and even our popular entertainment has had to shift to accommodate the perception we all have been inculcated with. But was justice served? Did O.J. get away with murder? Has the downward spiral of his life since been a kind of karmic punishment for a crime he got away with? Or was he innocent? Did someone else actually commit the murders? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Bill Deer. Bill Deer has worked all over the world as a homicide investigator. He began his career as a police officer in Miami, Florida. He lectures and teaches law enforcement around the world and was appointed by the court to the exhumation of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1981. He's received national and international attention on cases that made worldwide news coverage, and he has spent years investigating the O.J. Simpson case. He's the author of a new book entitled O.J. is Innocent and I Can Prove It. William Deer, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Good to have you here. Why did you get involved in this case in the first place?
Let me tell you how. I was speaking from the International Council of Reporters and Editors, like Time and Newsweek, at their big conference from all over the world that was in St. Louis, Missouri, on June 17, 1994, and that was the day of the so-called car chase. Mm-hmm. I just finished my speech and then was taking Q&A, and some of the reporters, I think 400 or 500, and they asked me what I thought, and I said, well, it's something probably concocted by O.J.'s lawyers, and he'll holler and scream as a result of all this publicity. It'll go on for hours and hours. He can't get a fair trial. Well, my son, I'm a single parent, was with me, and he said, Dad, you're assuming he's guilty. And I said, Michael, look at what they're showing. He said, yes, but you're the one that makes me put those signs up on the wall, never assume and always verify when you're teaching homicide. Well, you know, he was right and I was wrong. So about 4 days later, after returning to Dallas, I took one of the guys that had been with me for 20 years. We flew out on Saturday and saw what a media circus was going on at Bundy and Rockingham. I decided that I'd come back on Sunday night to Bundy and Dorothy, where Nicole's condo was, and I was intending on climbing over that back gate. And as people say for many, many years, they say I'm intuitive, but whether I'm intuitive or not, I had some concerns. So I walked in the back, walked up the alley, climbed over the back gate after moving some bushes.
Let me interrupt you for a second, Bill. What, they were police that were, you know, had been around there for days and days and days and days because it was such a circus.
Right.
Talk a little bit about, did they prevent you from doing this?
No, there was nobody there. It was surprising to me. I thought there would be. Now, there was do not cross crime scene tape in the front and in the back. There was. I have to be very honest, but I ducked underneath the tape. There was no one there. I told Chris that if by chance I did get arrested or picked up for questioning, you know, come get me out. So when I climbed over that back gate, I looked up and there was a security light right there at the top as you come over the back gate, and you looked up. It was there, but it apparently wasn't working, and probably wasn't working on the night of June 12th. So I walked that walkway. I've always tried to do this in some of my cases. I've tried to get into the mind of the killer. And in my mind, what I was doing was what the killer had. He'd crossed through the back gate or come through the back gate and walked that walkway as I was. So when I got to the front door, I saw the picture window. And I realized, my gosh, the picture window is right next door to the door. She would have seen who it was. Well, in Los Angeles, as you well know, like a lot of places, you certainly don't open the gates or the doors to a stranger. So I sat down. I looked and could still see some remaining blood there at the crime scene from Nicole and from Ron Goldman. But I also knew from what I'd been told in all these items that, you know, it didn't fit. As Johnny Cochran later said, if it didn't fit, you've got to quit. Well, as I'm sitting here, I realized that in my mind to that point, O.J. Simpson had been at the crime scene but did not commit the murder. I had also uncovered during that period of time after the murders that the Bronco had no blood on the brake, no blood on the accelerator, and then when I finally was able to find out exactly how much Marsha Clark had said, the Bronco was full of blood. Well, it wasn't. The total amount of blood could have fit on my thumbnail. So I thought, well, how can he fight with Ron Goldman here, as I'm sitting there? 27 stab wounds, a man who knows karate, who's used the word hey, hey, hey to try and protect himself by coming at him in a karate stance, and yet no blood on O.J. Simpson's bedroom, no blood on the staircase. The only drops were the drops leading away at Bundy and those five drops inside the foyer of the house. Well, that concerned me. You can't fight with somebody like that and not have had blood all over your hair and your ears, your nose, your shoes, but yet there was no blood on the breaker accelerator. Well, that was a red flag for me right there. And I thought, okay, if O.J. came to the scene and came afterwards, it would have had to have been because somebody called him. Well, that began my, I guess you'd call it, my 17-year search for the truth. I eventually wrote a book about 11 years ago, 2001, I think it was published, and I paid for it, and I thought, okay, I've done all this work, and I've got a lot of facts, a lot of theory, but I need hard, hard facts to continue. So I made it like a fishing book. I paid for it, published it, and sure enough, I end up getting exactly what I want and what I look for. Now, what have I accomplished? Number one, our suspect at the time was 24 years old, 5'11", 235, and for your listeners, he was on probation for assaulting his previous employer with a knife.
You're talking about O.J.'s son, Jason.
That's correct. O.J.'s son, Jason Lamar Simpson. There was two marriages by O.J. for your listeners. Number one, he married his high school and college sweetheart by the name of Marguerite. They had three children, not two. They had Arnell, they had Jason, and little Aaron, who was 23 months old, and they were all living at Rockingham, and Jason was supposed to be watching her while Arnell washed the family car up front. He walked away, and the child fell into the pool and drowned. Now, O.J. was extremely distraught over that because he idolized this little baby. Anyway, our suspect on probation at the time, we knew that he had a bad temper. We found records where he had checked into Cedars-Sinai Hospital just weeks prior to the murders and told the physician on duty, I'm about to rage. I'm out of my medication called Depakote. We had found empty bottles in his trash that showed Brentwood Pharmacy, 2 500 milligrams twice a day, and that was to control not only his bipolar, but to control his intermittent rage disorder.
Which O.J. knew about.
Correct. In fact, we even found a little statement to Jason where it said, Jason, you're going to have to take care of this. Your father will no longer pay for this. And this would have been after the murders of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. But in addition to that, we found that talking to one of his girlfriends, she said that in a fit of rage, he picked her up and threw her into a tub with no water and took her and pinned her on the floor and took his chef's knife out and cut off all her hair.
Well, back up a little bit, Bill, because I want to talk about the night of the murder,
right,
and the fact that Jason's alibi that night was that he was cooking at the restaurant where he worked as a sous chef,
That's right.
They were allegedly 200 people in the restaurant and that he was there and that people had seen him.
Well, as you may know, they had the recital for Little Sydney. And so after the recital, we found records that indicated that she was going to be coming to Jackson's restaurant at 8908 Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills, where Jason was going to be the acting chef that night because the regular chef, who actually was majority owner, Alan Ladd Jackson, wasn't going to be there that night. But the police had given him an airtight alibi that he was cooking in front of 200 people. But because of my book coming out, we received a call from the man who's the financial backer of this restaurant, who was very concerned, to the point the day after the murders on the 13th, he calls over and says, send me Jason Simpson's time card. They did. In fact, they hand-delivered it to him. He looked at it and said, Mr. Dear, that time card had been altered on that night. Where we have a time machine that was working, he had handwritten it in at 2:30, out at 10:30, initial JS. Yet 2 days after that, when he was back to work, the time clock was being stamped, which meant to us that time card had been replaced by this new one. We then checked and found that he'd left 55 minutes to an hour prior to the murders. There was no 200 people. The entire restaurant that night serviced not more than 30 to 40 people, and as a result, the grill was shut down early. His girlfriend had his Jeep, came in to pick him up, and they left around 9:30. According to witnesses, his girlfriend was crying. She gave him another alibi that they went directly to her house, which is a 5-minute drive from the restaurant. He went inside and stayed with her until late. Well, that turned out not to be true. Now we have no alibi whatsoever for our suspect on June 12th.
Let me stop you a second, Bill. He was never interviewed by the LAPD. Why?
That's it. Why not? You have a man who's on probation at the time for assaulting his previous employer. You have a man who suffers from rage disorder. It's a rage killing by an amateur. That's according to Marsha Clark and Hodgman and those people there. And yet they never, ever interview him whatsoever. Now, to me, that's shoddy, shoddy police work. And I hate to say that. I've been inducted in the Police Officers Hall of Fame as a private investigator, and I teach homicide. You don't all of a sudden have tunnel vision and make a rush for judgment like they did.
One of the reasons that they didn't interview him is that he hired counsel right away.
Talk about that. Well, apparently O.J. Simpson, within a day or two, hired Carl Jones to represent his son. Now, Carl Jones is a top criminal attorney in Los Angeles. So we found records when we filed a Freedom of Information Act request. It showed that, no, they never interviewed Jason Lamar Simpson. He was represented by counsel and refused to cooperate, which meant they never checked him for bruises, they never checked him for cuts. But according to one of the defense investigators, they interviewed Jason and said he had cut on his right hand, a bad cut. But yet LAPD never interviewed him, never did the district attorney interview him, and yet he should have been a major suspect, especially with the fact that he suffers rage, he carries his chef's knife. But more importantly, as a result of that book, in addition to the forged or altered time card, we ended up with the items that he had put into a storage facility. Now, this was just one box, not that big, into a big storage facility locker. Inside that storage box that we found and purchased from the person who purchased it was a series of photographs. One that, Jeff, it struck me out of the 40 or 50. There he is, our suspect, in bed with his dog wearing what we believe to be the same knit cap. Now, why is that so important? Number one, they found a knit cap at the crime scene at Bundy, along with the glove. And when they checked it, it had hair follicles from Afro-American man and dog hairs, but they never were able to substantiate that it belonged to OJ. But yet we have this picture. In addition to that, we had his dog's ashes. We have a note from his mother. Jason, I forgive you. I forgive you. Now, whether it's because of the child falling into the pool, little Aaron, or because of something else, we don't know. We did find where our suspect had three attempted suicide, been in a psychiatric unit, stabbed himself in the stomach with scissors, cut his wrist with broken glass, took an overdose of Depakote. Well, those to me are all major red flags, but in addition to that, at the bottom of this box was a knife. We pulled it out, and it was like a boot knife. It was black, and it had the initials scratched into it, JS. When we pulled it out, we looked at it, took it to a representative of Gerber for 35 years. He said, Mr. Deer, this is a replica of our Gerber Mark I, which is designed for one purpose, and that's to cut and to kill, except for the fact that the top piece, the hilt, had been removed, wax poured inside. Well, we could see the jagged edges from the top. Because of my concern and the lacerations in Nicole's skull, we took it to Dr. Vincent DeMaio, who's the author of Gunshot and Knife Wounds, had him and others look at it. They compared the top of the hilt of the knife to the lacerations sustained by Nicole, and it matched. They then compared this double-bladed knife, by the way, it's outlawed in California, that knife, and felt that the wounds sustained by Ron Goldman and Nicole were indicative of the double-bladed knife that we found in Jason's box in that store.
You also talk about the training that Jason had.
Right. He attended the Army-Navy Academy. Now, this is not the same that we know the military. This is a military thing for somewhat problem children, but in that they also teach you survival techniques. It is an Army-Navy type of college. So he was there for a period of time. We have to understand that Jason, at 14, had problems. Beat up his father's statue with a baseball bat. At 14, he was in the hospital for overdose. At 19, in the hospital for overdose. Used ecstasy, used mushrooms, used cocaine, used crack. I mean, these are all red flags to fit into what I consider a major suspect that should have been interviewed.
And had a drinking problem on top of all.
Severe. When you look at the Depakote, it said do not use with alcohol. We gathered his trash. Now, there was a reporter that took offense to this, and it's the only one it has, that we should not have gathered his trash. We should not have followed him occasionally. But I felt it was important because, to me, that evidence that we found in that trash, one particular piece, was a letter that he wrote. Dear Jason, there are three of us. Now, this is a man who's writing to himself as three people. And when you read the letter, and when it was difficult to read because in the trash it was wadded up, but on the outside it was a pencil or a pen was scraped over and over and over. So we took it to a lab, pulled it out, and when you looked at it, it was shocking. I mean, that's like we have his diaries that were also in that box in his storage facility. It's the year of the knife for me. I cut away my problems with a knife. If anybody would hurt one of my members of my family, I would kill them. I am tired of being Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. We confronted the LAPD and the DA's office and the Attorney General. They weren't interested.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between Jason and Nicole and the phone call that took place on the evening of the 12th.
According to Jason, he only gave one statement. That was the deposition.
And they asked him about the deposition in the civil trial.
In the civil trial. They never interviewed the criminal, but they did get him to give a deposition in the civil trial. And that verified a lot of the facts that we had. In it, he was asked about the fact that Nicole was supposed to come over, and he admits he was hurt. He was upset. She went to, as you know, Messaluna's restaurant. And he said in his deposition, she said it was more expensive. Well, it wasn't. It was the same price. But yet, she stood him up. We don't believe the call was ever made to him. And that was important. We think that she stood him up. He was angry because he prepared to have all these people showing up. It was his first time as a chef in a major restaurant. He'd have his family, his little brother and sister, his dad, and all these people there that he could show off his talent like O.J. did in the football. But not showing up. I don't believe he went over there with the intentions of killing her. I think he was mad. I think he'd been drinking. Because in addition to all the items that we pulled out of his trash, numerous bottles of alcohol, a lot of it tequila, which you don't mix. When you're suffering rage and you're suffering bipolar, you don't mix alcohol with drugs, especially Depakote. Well, if he went over there and got in her face, she's got in his. She's expecting Ron Goldman not only to deliver the glasses, but I think a little extra time. We knew that Jason had gone out dancing with her. They'd gone out to dinner together. He visited her repeatedly. In fact, Ron Shipp, mm-hmm. who was a policeman, said that he was called over to the previous address, which was on Gretna Green. And when he got there, she said that O.J. was stalking her, but then she admitted, I don't think it was O.J., I think it could have been Jason. Well, if Jason, who we know from his diaries, is an extremely jealous individual, she's expecting Ron Goldman, she's wanting him out of the way. If she came out that door, they got into a confrontation. We know that Nicole has a temper. In fact, we interviewed a maid, and the maid said that she got slapped so hard because she had told little Justin Sidney not to throw towels into the spa. And Nicole came over and said, you don't talk to my children, you don't correct her, and slapped her. Well, again, if she had slapped Jason and told him, I'm no longer your stepmother, I want you out of my life, that could have set him off because in his diaries he describes himself as Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and I'm tired of it, and he discusses a great deal else that could have set him off. He reaches down for the knife. About that time, Ron Goldman's coming in from the rear that's being expected. She turns, and I think he could have inverted the knife, come down on her skull, rendered her unconscious, because no matter what they tell you, Nicole died last, not first. The wound sustained by Nicole was not that of a fatal nature. She would have had to have stitches and certainly had a sore head, but she would not have died from the wound on the top of her head. As a result, the fight occurs. 27 stab wounds to Ron Goldman. We believe then that the assailant, who had been covered with blood, puts his foot on Nicole's back as she's coming to, pulls her back, her hair back, and then inflicts the fatal wounds.
Allegedly, after this takes place, you argue that Jason called O.J.
Right. He either called him or drove over there because it was only a four-minute drive from Bundy to Rockingham. And we believe at this point that either he and O.J. came back, because O.J. had visited him with him when he was in the psychiatric unit and knew that he hallucinated from time to time, but he also knew that he didn't sometimes would forget what he'd really done. And so O.J. could have come back, either by himself or with Jason, walked in the back with the gloves on, knew he had to get back very quickly. He also was concerned over Justin and Sydney, walked in that walkway from the back, sees Nicole lying in a fetal position, takes off the glove, bends down, and realizes as he's touching her, she's dead, and the body goes one way, the head the other. I think he dropped the glove, looked up, and sees Ron Goldman with his eyes wide open and blood everywhere, and panics and leaves. Then he comes and leaves, gets back into the Bronco. Remember, there was no blood on the brake or the blood on the accelerator, which would have meant that he didn't fight this, didn't fight Ron Goldman. We believe he pulled in the back and came over the back gate, either he or Jason or both, climbed over the back gate behind the bungalows, because you can see the, we learned through an expert that the metal prongs on the 4-foot chain link fence had been mashed down, and a limb where you could grab onto and lift yourself up and over the gate. And I think at that point, O.J. or somebody dropped that glove, and O.J. then spun around and hit the air conditioning units or the walls where Cato Kaelin was talking to his girlfriend. We know that Alan Parks was waiting for O.J. in the limo to take him, but he was on the outside. He saw a dark figure coming across and entering the back. He doesn't know whether it was O.J. or whether it was somebody else. But at that point, we believe that that would have been the second trip and the fatal trip.
Given this, why would O.J. continue to make this trip?
Well, he went on to Chicago because he expected the Hertz tournament. If once O.J. left that crime scene, he became part of the crime. In fact, even now, he could be charged for conspiracy or complicity because he left the crime scene knowing full well who did it. Once he got on that plane and left over a state line, it became also a federal offense. But if he did not, and we do know this, everybody calls him very narcissistic. He is. I don't doubt that at all. But there's one weak spot that he has. He blames himself for not being a good father when he was playing football. He tried to make it up to these children, and he cares about these four kids. And to me, I think he would go to his grave without giving up our suspect, if I am correct with all the evidence that I've acquired. Because when you compare the evidence of O.J. compared to the evidence that we have accumulated on Jason, O.J.'s son, it's overwhelming.
You talk about O.J.'s demeanor that the night of the recital. Talk about that.
He was laughing. We could see him with, you know, you have to understand Nicole's father and mother loved O.J. Simpson. They just thought he was one of the nice people in the world. I've looked at film where he was shaking hands, he was laughing. Yet according to the police, he was planning a premeditated murder of Nicole. Well, let me tell you how that blows out. Number one is Nicole was expecting to have a sleepover that night. When O.J. was not invited to dinner with them later, O.J. left, but he left with Sydney telling him, "Dad, I'm going to have so-and-so over for the night." He's not going to plan a premeditated murder when he's got the children, who this is summer, and he's got a sleepover when everybody knows that two little girls are not going to go right to bed. They're going to laugh and have fun. And yet they believed he planned this premeditated murder after he went to McDonald's with Cato Kaelin. It doesn't fly in anybody's mind. It should not fly. That's another major red flag. He did not know that at the last moment, after they got home, the sleepover was canceled. O.J. would not have that knowledge.
Talk a little bit about what would have happened with Jason and where his bloody clothes allegedly would have gone.
I think he either removed them at the time, but we also know that he wore a white chef's jacket. He was the sous chef, so he would prepare the meat normally. On this particular night, he would have had blood on his clothes from preparing the food. If he was angry and dropped off his girlfriend, by the way, we've been able to verify that he did drop her off. He admits that, but he says he never went upstairs and drove directly home to his place and stayed there. Well, we know that's not true. So if he had these bloody clothes on, he could have gone back to Jackson's restaurant where he had a key and had the code. They picked up the bloody clothes from the chefs and everybody else on Monday. He then also took off the clothes, put them into the clothes hamper, removed his time card, put it in his pocket or destroyed it, and then put the new one back in at 2:30, out at 10:30. And that would have accounted for why it was penciled in and not with a time clock.
Talk a little bit about O.J.'s reaction, though, after he would have allegedly known what had happened.
Well, according to people that talked to him on the plane, this is a funny story, too. I came back from Los Angeles the other day, I think it was last week, and coming back, there was a man who seated next to me, and we started talking. He saw my book, O.J. Simpson, I Can Prove It. He said, I'm getting ready to get that book. He said, "It's from what I've been told, it's a great book." I said, yes, I think it is. By the way, I wrote it. He said, oh, my gosh. So he shook my hand. He said, well, I used to be O.J.'s next-door neighbor in Brentwood. And I said, no kidding. He said, Mr. Deere, I will tell you this, that O.J. was very nice to all our neighbors. He said, he had some wild parties, but he said, all in all, he'd wave at people, talk to people. We'd see him at the movies there, and he was a really nice person. Well, when O.J. got on that plane, they said he signed autographs and everything else. Very cordial. And in his mind, though, I think that he realized that, oh, my God, you know, what have I done? I also think if he had been wearing those Bruno Magli shoes, we know that he had a small little bag with him when he came out of the house, and the limousine, Alan Parks, pulled up, and Cato helped load, and somebody reached for the bag and said, no, I'll take that. We also know that when he was driving to the airport, he told the limo driver, it's awful hot back here. He turned his back and rolled the window down, and we believe at that point he threw out the little bag. What was contained in the bag, I'm not sure, but I do believe it was probably, if he had been wearing the Brunos, which would have been the only thing of evidence that would have lent him to the crime scene, it went out the window. It was many weeks go by before the Bruno Magli shoes were brought into it. We also know that Jason wore the shoes. Jason wore O.J.'s clothes. Jason's size was 11.5, and O.J.'s was 12, which is very, very close. We know there were two sets of prints coming and going. And so if you looked at that, and then at the fact that when O.J. got back, was called, he immediately went to Rockingham, and Van Etter and Lang asked him if he'd be willing to come down to the station and give a statement. He said yes. And his attorneys objected. He said, no, I have nothing to hide. So he goes with them and goes down to the LAPD jail. They then photographed him with a registered nurse by the name of Thano Paritis, one of the nicest men you'll ever meet, 38 years with as a registered nurse in charge of the jail there, and who, by the way, has passed away. And he told me when I interviewed him that they asked O.J. to strip, and they photographed him. The only cut was on his left knuckle, which Thano offered him a Band-Aid for it because it looked like he was bleeding. He then was told by Van Etter and Lang to draw blood. He drew 8 cc's of blood and put it into a purple type cap, which contained EDTA. He shook it, like a lot of you people, if you've gone to the doctor and they draw blood, you see them shake it. Now, why are they shaking it? Because the EDTA granules surround the glass vial. By shaking it up, it mixes and preserves the blood for testing at a later date. We know that out of protocol, Van Etter asked for the vial of blood. He put it in his pocket. And Thano said, I drew 8 cc's, but when it was returned later that evening, there was only 6.5. We also know that there were a pair of socks found at the foot of O.J.'s bed. Supposedly one minute they're there, next minute apparently they're not there. But anyway, the socks in itself were lying right there in plain view later. When they took the socks in for evidence, they found that there was blood from O.J. and blood from the coal on the socks. But further testing, according to Dr. Reeder, and Dr. Reeder was one of the top experts in the country that the FBI uses, he checked and found that the blood on the socks contained EDTA and that the blood went from side to side, which meant that the blood containing EDTA, according to him and others, came from a vial of blood and had been dripped on the socks when there was no foot in it.
If O.J. was so concerned about his son, and his son had counsel early on, why didn't O.J. take steps earlier to get counsel himself?
He did. Jason was under the care of Dr. Burton Kitay, K-I-T-T-A-Y. But in his diaries, he writes, I can tell this doctor anything I want. He's gullible. He believes anything you tell him. Sadly, but that's the case.
A little bit about what O.J.'s lawyers knew and when did they know it?
I don't believe they knew that he was covering for somebody else.
Why not?
I just don't. I think that Shapiro said in his book early on that he suspected Jason Simpson, O.J.'s oldest son. But he said the police department had given him an airtight alibi that he was cooking in front of 200 people and didn't leave until after 10:30. Well, now we're able to prove that's not true. Well, that's it. And also then Petruccelli, the civil lawyer, wrote a book, and in it he said his staff would occasionally laugh and say, well, Petruccelli, why couldn't it have been Jason? It was a kind of a standing joke. Well, it wasn't any joke. It's turned out that Jason Simpson should have been a major suspect and should definitely be a major suspect now.
Talk about what happened to Jason's life after this incident.
Continued to drink. Continued to try, from time to time, medication. We also know that he stalked his previous girlfriend in New York, where she tried to get away from. That's the one he cut off all her hair and threw in a tub with no water. Came back. We know that he went from job to job to job to job. Let me tell you another one. After the murders, he went to work as an acting chef. He lived in a little tiny apartment off in Venice Beach, and he would have his dog with him. Now, he was late to work constantly, but he went to work at a place called Angel's Bistro there in Venice Beach. It was a very small place, maybe 30 or 40 people it held, and this was an Italian place. Gil Garcetti had run for re-election and lost. My book came out, my first one, and according to the gentleman who owned it from England, he said one afternoon just before the lunch crowd, a man walked in, picked up the menu, and said to me, I want to speak to your chef, Jason Simpson. He said, I'm sorry, Jason no longer works here. He said, well, your menu says he does. He said, I'm sorry, but he doesn't. And he threw the menu, wadded up, threw the menu down, and walked out, and he recognized that it was Gil Garcetti, who had been the district attorney at the time. Well, again, Jason had lost that job there, as he had lost many jobs. We know that he left for Georgia, and he'd worked a number of jobs there, lost his jobs there, went down to Florida, lost his jobs there. We know that his phone, last we heard, has been disconnected. So he has probably had, I would imagine, since the murders, 30 jobs, and he can't get along. He has a bad temper. We just received an email yesterday from a young man. Plus, we received emails from his roommates at the Army-Navy Academy that said when it first came out, they suspected JJ. That's what they called Jason.
Mm-hmm. What was the relationship between Jason and OJ after the murders?
That we're not sure of. We know that he quit paying for the medication at Brentwood, which he'd paid for. They acted like they were kind of isolated, that he was there, but it just didn't seem like they were close anymore. But I know he looked out after him because he hired this criminal lawyer to represent him. But during the trial, Jason got arrested again, this time for hit and run and drinking, DUI.
Do we think that OJ ever told anyone what really happened, as you see it?
No, I think that probably AC probably surmised that, but I don't believe it. He may have told Rosie Greer, who's a minister of God, but I don't believe he told anybody. I think he's got it to himself. As you probably know, he's in prison. Your listeners mm-hmm. may or may not know. He's right. In Nevada prison for trying to get back items that these two memorabilia dealers were selling that belonged to him that he had given to a number of memorabilia dealers to hold till the time was right because he had filed bankruptcy. And apparently a man who's a four-time convicted felon had made arrangements for these two guys to come from L.A., meet him in Las Vegas, went down, looked at the items in the trunk. Unbeknownst to them, he had wired the room for sound. O.J. was downstairs having drinks when this gentleman went down and said, hey, they're selling your memorabilia upstairs. O.J. got mad and went upstairs with some guys. We don't think he knew anything about a gun. Went in there and wanted only his items. By the way, the court has given him back the items that he took that belonged to him. Yet he's still in prison. He's the only one. And yet our person who wired the room for sound made over $100,000 for setting up O.J. Simpson.
Have you ever spoken with O.J.?
I had the opportunity to do so through Kathy Ronda, his secretary for many years. I chose not to. I felt that this book had to be unbiased, the same way I've not met with Nicole's family, because I felt until I had everything, I didn't, because, you know, Ron Goldman's dad is adamant that O.J. Simpson's guilty. Now I'm hoping that he reads the book from the very beginning to the very end and realizes what exactly happened, because it is factual. It's no longer theory. Every step I've taken from the very beginning, I incorporated both the first and second together to try and show how I got involved in this, so that you're the investigator, you're looking at the stuff I've uncovered, you're looking at the facts, and you're looking at my attempts to contact the police department to no avail, and you make that decision of innocence or guilty, or whether or not there should be a grand jury hearing, which has been my goal all along, and let them look at what's happened.
Talk a little bit about your attempts to contact both the Los Angeles District Attorney and the State Attorney General.
Well, I received numerous conversations back and forth by email, and most of them are, we already know what you're talking about. There does not necessitate a meeting. We met in 2008, and went with five members of the Attorney General staff in Los Angeles, five great people as far as I was concerned, four men and one woman. We showed them what we had. They were very, very excited. They thought that, wow. And their comment was, let us handle this because LAPD was not going to help you. We will. Well, at that time, Jerry Brown was the Attorney General. We did not know that within a few months he was going to be filing for governor again. Well, they asked us to give them 2 weeks, make sure this information was put in a safe place. We put it into a bank vault. And then 2 weeks went to three and four. The verdict of O.J. Simpson was found where he was found guilty. Then we get an email that said, we've examined the evidence, not enough evidence on your theories. Case, we're not interested. So basically the case was closed. Then we got an email one day from the LAPD media division that said, O.J. Simpson killed Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. The jury found him not guilty. Case closed. Well, there is no statute of limitations on homicide. Never will be, as far as I'm concerned, nor witnesses. So if they want to open it, they could. But I don't believe they want these facts to come out, because when you look at the cover of the book, you even have Dan Rather up there. You've got some of the top, Cecil Wett, one of the top experts in the country, Dr. Vincent DeMaio, Dr. Al Harper, Dr. Henry Lee. You know, my reputation speaks for itself, and the facts I've uncovered speaks for itself. But let me also share with you. About two years ago, I filed a Freedom of Information Act wanting to examine the knit cap and the gloves, because I knew now, with the picture I had, that if it wasn't O.J.'s hair, and it would in all likely be our suspects. Well, I got back an email, I think, from Hodgman, who said it's in the book. And it said, we've been unable to locate the knit cap or the gloves. But we do have photographs, and we'll make arrangements for you to look at them. I already had those, so I emailed back. Do you mean that you can't find them, that they're lost? Well, they never responded. To this day, they've never responded. But they did say at the bottom, when we do find them, we'll let you know for inspection. Well, we found them in 2010, and where were they? They were at a Las Vegas homicide convention sponsored by the LAPD, and there they were in a case, clear-cut case, to be examined by people along with Bobby Kennedy's shirt and other pieces of evidence. And yet they said they couldn't find them. But in the book, you'll see the pictures, how we found them.
What do you hope to come from this at this point?
A grand jury hearing, an independent counsel to look and examine the evidence, to interview the people that we've come up with, and hopefully a new indictment for possibly the new for our suspect.
Do you think that the LAPD or the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office acted with reckless disregard for the facts, or simply followed the facts as they perceived them at the time?
I think they went the rush for judgment. They perceived them the way they were. I don't believe if they'd have made a diligent effort to look at other suspects, which they claimed they were going to do so. Well, how could you overlook a suspect who's on probation for assault with a knife? A knife is a weapon of choice. They showed that when they first introduced into the preliminary hearing, they introduced this stiletto that O.J. had purchased from Ross Cuttery when he was doing the series of Frogman there in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Well, when the knife was examined, it was determined there was no blood in it. Wouldn't even fit the criteria for the wounds. That was disregarded. And the second, then they thought it was a Swiss Army knife because O.J. was on the board of Swiss Army knife. They did away with that. Then they determined it had to be a double-bladed knife or two single-bladed knives. Well, we have a double-bladed knife. We have a knife that is outlawed in the state of California. We have the hilt being removed that fits the laceration to Nicole's skull. I don't know how many more red flags you have to bring up before you start looking in the right place with this type of evidence.
And does anybody know where Jason Simpson is today?
No, I think he's either in outside of Atlanta in New Smyrna, or he's back down in Florida someplace.
Has anyone talked to him about some of the evidence that's presented here?
Well, I know that in our first book we put a lot of evidence in there, a lot of theory, a lot of evidence. He certainly knew 11 years ago that he was, because of my investigation, a major suspect. I would see no reason why it would change now. But we have more substantial stuff today than we had 11 years ago.
William Deere, the book is O.J. is Innocent and I Can Prove It. Bill, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope that people will pick it up, look at it, and vote at the back where we have a ballot that they can email it to us, because to me it's important to find finally that justice does prevail and give closure to Nicole Simpson's family and to Ron Goldman's.
Bill Deere, thanks a lot.
Thank you.